You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Since the advent of the Industrial Revolution, people have predicted that machines would make human labor obsolete. Our guest says we might still be heading in that direction.
In a recent article in The Atlantic, he explores a host of possibilities and many questions. What would a world look like without work or without all of us working? How would it change society? How would humans respond when they can no longer find work?
Derek Thompson joins us now. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic, where he writes about economics, labor markets, and the entertainment business. Derek, welcome back.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Well, for the past several hundred years, people have warned that machines will eventually replace human jobs. That hasn't completely happened. We've seen that to a certain extent. But why should we start taking that kind of prediction more seriously now?
It's true. This is a prediction that has been proved wrong and wrong over and over again. In the piece, I call it "The Boys Who Cried Robot." All of these economists and politicians and scientists saying, "Oh, well, robots or machines are going to take everybody's jobs," just around the corner, and it hasn't happened yet. So, right, why now? There's a couple statistics that I think you can look at that are sort of underlying what has otherwise appeared to be a healthy recovery. For example, the inactivity rate of men, the share of prime-age men between 25 and 54 who aren't working is more than doubled since the 1970s, and a lot of people think this is because technology has taken from them the sort of jobs for which they're most likely to do, like in manufacturing. The other thing is that, you know, if you look at the most common jobs in the U.S. economy right now, cashier, retail salesperson, office administrator, driving is the most common occupation among American men. These are all jobs where either there are technologies that we can see right now that could potentially replace them if they got a little bit better, whether it's online shopping to replace retail salespeople, or there are technologies that a lot of people see right around the corner, like self-driving cars, which not only are Google and Uber working on, but also Toyota and lots of other car companies. So I think it's reasonable to say that the prediction has been wrong, but software and automation that exists today is much more dexterous than the manufacturing technology that was disrupted 50 years ago, and we should recognize that as a potentially scary fact.
Right. We've had in our heads these categories of jobs that you can't do without humans, that machines, computers can never take over. That list seems to be shrinking year after year.
Right. There was this great study from Oxford that basically lined up every single job in the United States from the most automatable, say, typist, to the least automatable, like, let's say, anesthesiologist or something like that. They essentially predicted that within two decades, machines will be able to do half of that list. But I think that it's interesting to look at the far end of the list, the least automatable jobs, and to think about how, with a little bit of creativity, they might be done by machines. So, for example, psychologists are one of the least automatable jobs, according to Oxford. But some studies suggest that some people are more comfortable confessing their deepest, darkest secrets to a machine rather than a person because the machine won't pass moral judgment. So you imagine that finding connected to something like IBM Watson, which roots through the history of millions of people with similar problems and suggests something personalized from that. And it's easy to see how, on the margin, some people might choose automated therapy, automated psychology, rather than visiting someone for hundreds of dollars a session. I'm not suggesting, I should be clear, that I think there will be no work for psychologists in the future. There will be lots of work for psychologists, lots of people who want to talk to somebody to help them through their week. I'm simply saying that at the margin, we shouldn't be so confident that there is this hard and fast moat that exists around certain jobs that computers can never infringe on. The technology is much more dexterous, I think, than a lot of people estimate.
Well, and one theory over the years has been that, sure, there'll be new technology, but it will be complementary. It will help us do our jobs instead of taking away jobs. How has that panned out?
Well, it's panned out, you know, in a way where there are lots of people who are working with machines and jobs that didn't exist before. You know, this is something that economists call creative disruption. You have machines move us off of the farms and into factories. We used to be an agrarian economy. We used to be a manufacturing economy. And now we're a services economy. And this is all because of technology and globalization, moving us from, one dominant sector to another. But I do think that creative disruption, creative destruction, I should say, say, can be overrated. The vast majority of people, 90%, are working in occupations that existed 100 years ago. And lots of the newest companies, lots of the startups, are much more labor efficient than the legacy companies that they're trying to take down. So if you compare sort of telecommunications companies, in 1964, AT&T was the largest company in America. It was worth about $270 billion in today's dollars. It employed about 800,000 people. Today, its analog might be Google. Google is worth even more than AT&T in sort of updating for inflation, but it employs 90% fewer people. So you can simply create a lot more value with fewer people these days. So of course, technology is complementary and it can create lots of jobs, but it also I think can displace work as well.
Talking to Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, about the end of work, at least the end of work as we know it, and what happens to our lives when there are fewer jobs, when we're just not needed as humans, as workers so much anymore. And Derek, let's turn to that now, a future where our technology is more productive, we have more time on our hands, but maybe less income. How do we start rearranging our lives?
So I imagine three futures, and I call those futures consumption, creativity, and contingency. And I'll run quickly through them. Consumption is this idea that, you know, when middle-aged men or younger men lose their job, they tend to spend a lot of time watching television and surfing the internet. And so it's possible that given lots of leisure time, we just sort of sit on our couches and look at screens. It's possible that this is better maybe than absolute drudgery at work, but I don't think it's exactly the entire flourishing of the human spirit. And so I would hope that people, you know, do more with their downtime. And so I look to the second future of creativity. I visit Columbus, Ohio, and I talk to people in a maker space, which is sort of like a gymnasium of tools called the Columbus Ideas Foundry, where there are people who are drawing and teaching and painting and welding and working with a metal lathe. And what I like about this future is it sort of takes what some people call the third space in our lives. Not the first space, our home, or the second place, our office, but that place we kind of want to be outside of our home if we could spend infinity time there. It elevates that third space to a central role in our lives. It allows us to be creative with other people. Freed from drudgery, we expand our minds. The third future is I go to Youngstown, Ohio. That Youngstown is a city that was devastated in the 1970s by the evaporation of the steel industry. And it is somewhat a metaphor for the decline of the middle class in the last 3.5 decades. A lot of people there are working part-time. They don't have full-time gigs. They have lives of what economists call contingency. They're working as bartenders and also painters and also sort of car sort of fixer-uppers and urban agriculture workers. They're doing a lot of different things. And this is not outright dystopia, even though a lot of them are living with very little money. They do develop a certain amount of pride from the ability to spend some time doing things that they're passionate about. But it's a complicated future, and it's neither entirely good nor entirely depressing. And so I try to sort of see these futures as living alongside each other.
And looking at that first concept of leisure, if we have all this time on our hands, even if we don't have money, there seems to be a lot of evidence that people actually want to work. There's some sort of intrinsic value that the human psyche almost needs that would be hard to replace.
This is a really, really hard question to answer, and I do my best to answer it, but I probably don't do a perfect job. You know, do people need to work to be happy? That is a central question to this piece. And I don't know for sure. And the reason I can't know for sure is because right now people, the vast majority of people, have to work in order to make money, and you have to have money in order to live. And so what we have to do is think about this hypothetical. What if you couldn't work? What if the government paid you a certain amount of money, what economists call a universal basic income, so that you could choose to do things or do nothing with your time? Would you still be happy if you weren't actually doing anything? My guess is that you wouldn't be happy. My thinking is that in studies, it seems like when people spend a lot of time being idle, a lot of time being sort of couch potatoes, they feel unexpectedly a sense of anxiety about this. They feel guilty. They feel lacking in purpose and meaning. You know, I want people to be happy, and I'm interested in researching and constructing a future in which, you know, people can flourish. Some people just want to watch TV, and that's fine, but it doesn't seem like having a life of pure leisure gives one the same feeling of accomplishment and purpose in the world that I think is a higher value than mere contentment.
You know, do people need to work is one question. Do Americans need to work is maybe another
right.
question. Is there something about our ethos of work here in this country that makes this a harder nut to crack?
I truly think that work is something like a religion of the United States, an unofficial, non-denominational religion of our politics and of our culture. There is an expectation that virtue comes from work, and maybe this is a Protestant virtue. I don't know exactly how far back to trace it. But, you know, you look at the last 50 years of productivity growth, and Europeans have used their productivity growth to work a lot less. In Germany and the Netherlands, hours worked per year per full-time worker have fallen by as much as 50% since the middle of the century. In the U.S., it's fallen by much less. We do seem to work much more than other countries that are similarly advanced. And again, it's very difficult to know for sure where this interest and this fascination with working comes from. Does it come from the fact that Americans are right, that work does give us meaning? Or does it come from the fact that Americans are wrong, that we should spend our productivity and spend our richness by spending more time with our children and our families and our communities, and that we're obsessed with work in a way that is quietly or not so quietly unhealthy? You know, these are difficult questions, and I run through some studies that suggest, that sort of provide evidence for both sides. But it is sort of the central fascination of my piece.
We're talking about the future of work, and you can join the conversation. Have you lost a job or been forced to change careers because of some kind of technological development? Are job losses because of these technological advances always a bad thing, or could it create a future in which maybe we have more leisure time that we'd be doing good stuff with? Would you be happier if you could live comfortably without a job, or at least a full-time job? Call it 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about a future in which machines and technology could make a lot of jobs obsolete. What do you think? Are humans going to be victims of their own innovation, find themselves out of work? What does it mean to work if you're a human being, and what would the world look like without it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or email us on talk@WPR.org.
Atlantic Magazine senior editor Derek Thompson is with us. He wrote the article, A World Without Work, in the latest issue. We'll go right to our callers now. We've got Lucy on the line in Madison. Lucy, hi.
Hi. I just want to say there's a lot of work in our society that nobody is paying to do, but it seriously needs to be done. A lot of child care work. Right now, a lot of lower-income people really can't afford child care because the child care subsidies available are totally inadequate. I do a lot of volunteer work. I've been retired for quite a while now, and I do a lot of volunteer work with a bunch of low-income children, and I've been doing that since before I retired. And early on, when I was in my 20s, I worked at a nursing home, and I became aware that a lot of older people in nursing homes aren't very adequately cared for, and I think that it's always difficult to get adequate funding to care for older people.
Lucy, thanks a lot for that call. And Derek, in your piece, one scenario you lay out is maybe a Depression-era-style works program to hire these newly unemployed people to do exactly these kind of jobs, elder care, child care, things like that.
Yeah, I think this is a completely utterly wonderful point to raise, which is that, you know, economics is not a morality play. The people who are paid the most are not necessarily doing the work. work that is of most civic good. And on the other hand, people who are paid nothing, let me restate, people who are doing essential work, raising children, caring for the sick, caring for the elderly, donating their time to community service, sometimes this work is compensated poorly or not at all. There's lots of negative scenarios that can be painted and that I do paint in this piece about machines and automation replacing a lot of full-time work. At the same time, it's easy to be optimistic in this small way by saying, you know, what if we freed up a lot of time and a lot of people and a lot of talent for taking care of and spending more time devoting our energies toward these essential activities that aren't rewarded that much right now by the labor market, caring for people and making sure that the most vulnerable people in our society, whether it's babies or the sick or the elderly, are cared for. I think this is a huge point, and this is one of those areas where I think that a scenario where automation takes care of a lot of the jobs that are currently occupied by the labor force would allow us to devote more of our time to these sort of things.
Lucy, thanks a lot for that call. We go next to Brendan in Milwaukee. Hi, Brendan.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. I just wanted to call. I think it was a really great topic. Really encouraged that it's being talked about, especially in a platform like WPRN and in The Atlantic. And just wanted to comment on actually working right now on a theology of work and vocation under a research grant through Marquette and working under the direction of a theologian there. And we're teasing out of a lot of these same questions and maybe offering some hypotheses, obviously, with theology in terms of where we derive purpose and if there were, you know, a full-scale automation to replace a lot of jobs, that people would still seek something to do with their time, you know. So it depends on, one, how you're defining work, and then two, you know, what that work is producing. So I guess I just wanted to offer that and compliment Derek on writing such an important topic.
Well, Brendan, thanks a lot for that. And Derek, you know, he used the word theology, gets up this notion of work as a calling, as something more than just a job. What does that get at to you?
No, it's a great point, and I'm really happy that other people are working on this. Not so much theologists, but psychologists, and perhaps psychologists that the caller is reading. They have this tripartite theory of work that says there's essentially three categories of work. There are jobs, careers, and callings. And calling has a little bit of this sort of theological purpose attached to it. A job is something that you do for money. A calling is something that people do for the status that sort of mastery and developing your career brings. And then the calling is something that you do for love of the work itself, for the intrinsic fulfillment of the activity. It's not so much that every single job fits into only one bucket. There are jobs that pay lots of money, where people advance in their careers, and they're incredibly passionate about the work they do. But a lot of jobs, you know, fall into one when people are sort of making the trade-off of, do I take one job that pays a lot but does very little civic good and I don't enjoy the work, versus another job that doesn't pay very much, but the minute-to-minute process of the job is, you know, sort of feeds my soul. It is possible to me, and the piece ends on this sort of hopeful note, that as machines and automation takes care of more of the jobs, you know, does that free up people to find their calling? I am ambivalent on this question. On the one hand, I think that the opportunity is there. On the other hand, a lot of times finding the thing that you love, the thing that you're wonderful at, requires discipline. And that discipline often requires schooling, and we go to school because we expect to have a job at the end. And so, in a way, the labor force itself is, for many people, certainly not all, but for many people, a mechanism for helping people discover the thing that they are truly passionate about. And so the question is, you know, how do people find that discipline and that calling and that love of work if you don't have the same labor signals being sent? I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm just saying it becomes a tricky question, and perhaps a question in which, you know, you need philosophers to begin to think through it right now.
Well, if the philosophers are thinking through it, is that enough? Or is our society as a whole, our government leaders, our business leaders, us as individuals, are we thinking about this massive shift enough?
Right. In a piece, I talk about how the government can begin to prepare us for this future. I have a couple ideas. One, which is popular among liberals right now, but ironically was proposed by a conservative economist and even bandied under Richard Nixon's administration, is the universal basic income. The idea that you pay everybody a certain amount of money every single month from the government, a bit like Social Security for all, and that allows people to maintain their dignity in the face of declining full-time job opportunities. There's also, I think money itself is not enough to replace the virtues of work. I also suggest, the government thinking about creating something like a digital WPA at the local government level, a way to connect underemployed people with either government projects like caring for the sick or individual projects like somebody posting something that says, I'm interested in hiring an artist or hiring a tutor or hiring a carpenter for a brief period of time.
And Derek, we'll leave it with that idea. And we've got that piece posted on our Central Time Facebook page. Derek, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you very much.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret will be back with me tomorrow. Some new data analysis is giving us some food for thought when it comes to music and pop culture, suggesting that as we age, we lose interest in discovering new music and exploring bands and songs and genres that expand our musical horizons. That's according to a researcher who broke down data from the music service Spotify. The turning point, according to the study, age 33. That's when users appear to stop checking out new music of the day, instead going back to the music of their glory days, of the teens and 20s. This is not peer-reviewed public science, but a great conversation starter. Our next guest has been thinking about these issues for a long time now. Stephen Hayden is a music writer based here in Wisconsin. He's a staff writer at Grantland. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Stephen, you wrote about this 4 years ago when you were at this turning point age, the age of 33. What do you think changes in our musical lives in our early 30s that we start to get kind of fossilized?
Well, I think there's a number of factors that happen. I mean, if you compare music to movies or television, music is so much more vast than those areas. You know, the music is changing all the time. There's so many artists. It just takes a lot more work to keep up with popular music. So, as you enter your 30s, your life gets fuller. You get married, you have kids, you have a mortgage, and you don't have the free time necessarily to keep up with music. I also think that there's something about music that people use when they're teenagers to form their identities. Like when you're a teenager, a lot of times, if you get into a certain genre or a certain band, that becomes a big part of who you are, and it's how you define yourself. So, like, if you're into punk rock, for instance, you see yourself as a punk, and you define yourself against what, punk is supposed to be against. And it's interesting how that sense of identity doesn't necessarily change as you get older. You still hold on to that. Even when you're no longer a kid. So I think sometimes people, they have these sort of entrenched biases that they take from, their teen years and their 20s, and when they get older, they don't want to let it go. And it's such a part of who they are that, like, taking something that's new can be really difficult.
But then why wouldn't people just keep following that particular genre? Say, if you like punk music, you keep up on whatever bands sound like they're the latest in punk music and follow the thread along, like you might, say, with a kind of movie or a book. What's different about music?
It's interesting because, that does make sense that you would just follow the genre as it develops over the years. But,
Stephen, are you still with us? And it looks like we lost Stephen. We're going to try to reconnect with him right now. And in the meantime, we're curious about what you think about this. Does this sound like you? Did you hit, say, around age 33 and then decide you were kind of done listening to new music, looking for new music, hunting it down, and you set your musical preferences? You're still listening to the stuff from your 20s or your teens, for that matter. Call us and let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Stephen is back with us now. Stephen, you were talking about why it might be that we don't keep just following a particular genre of music.
Yeah, as I was saying, it's interesting because, you know, like when I was growing up, you know, we would always have to deal with our parents telling us that, like, the music that we loved wasn't as good as the music that they grew up with. And, you know, when you're a kid, you always think, well, I'm never going to be that closed-minded when I become an adult. And yet now that, you know, I'm in my 30s and I you know, see friends of mine who now have kids, you know, they're saying the same thing. You know, they're talking about music that they grew up in the 90s being better than music now. And I think part of that is that, you know, as you get older, you have a longer perspective on music. You know, like, it's not like when you're a kid, and like for instance, you know, when I was growing up in the 90s, like when you hear Nirvana for the first time, that might be the first type of band like that you ever heard. So then they sound revolutionary because your frame of reference is so much more limited. But then 20 years after that, you've heard lots of music. You have a much, you know, you're much more educated in a way. So things don't sound as fresh. And anything that's newer, I think, tends to sound derivative sometimes to people who are older. So you end up, you know, in a situation where, like, you have old people saying, well, this new band is just a ripoff of something that I liked 20 years ago, and which is the same thing that our parents said when we were kids. So I think for some reason it's just harder for people to hear, I guess, the nuances and what's new now. You know, there just seems to be this impulse for people when they get older to dismiss things as just being rehashed, you know, and things were better when they were younger.
Well, do you think there's anything to that argument before we totally dismiss it, that maybe pop culture is sort of evolutionary in a sense, and the weak get winnowed out and the things that are the best get distilled and brought forward, and maybe it's sort of a narrowing tip of a pyramid in terms of goodness when it comes to music?
I mean, I think that's definitely true. I think that things do get rehashed, and obviously, you know, every new band that comes along has influences, and they're going to start out early in their careers by, like, sort of emulating their influences and trying to reach, you know, what their heroes did. I think where the fallacy comes in is the belief that, like, when you were younger, things were original, and now they're rehashed. The fact is that when you were a kid, things were also rehashed. It's just that you didn't know it. You thought that this was something fresh and new. I mean, but that's just what art is. Art is a continuum, you know, like, especially music. It's a set of sounds and attitudes and lyrics and all that kind of stuff that gets passed down. And the more that you know about music, the more you can see that. And I think that's kind of fascinating, personally. Like, I love having that perspective of, like, you know, having heard stuff from 20 years ago and then comparing it to stuff that comes out now and seeing what gets changed and what remains the same and what gets carried forward and just kind of experiencing that continuum, you know, rather than being turned off by it.
And do you think we might also see music from our 20s as the best of our life because we're young then? Maybe we're at peak happiness when we're our 20s and, I guess, early 30s.
Well, absolutely. I definitely think, you know, when we talk about memory, like, music is, like, one of the strongest sort of catalysts for how we remember the past. You know, it's like the old cliche about hearing a song on the radio and remembering everything about your life the first time you heard it. You know, I mean, there's countless examples of that. And I think certainly, you know, as you get older and, you know, your life is maybe not as carefree as it once was, you know, like in your teens and 20s, if you're hearing songs from that era, you know, it might be a form of escapism for you, you know, to relive that. And I think that's totally fine. I think that's one of the great things about music, the sort of way that it can transport you out of your body to, like, different times in your life. I think where it becomes a problem is, like, when you maybe get a little closed off from the world and only live in the past, when, in fact, you know, there's a lot of good things that are happening in the present.
We're talking right now to music critic Stephen Hayden about the way our attitudes toward music change over time. Recent articles suggesting that a lot of us sort of fossilize at the age of 33 and we stop listening to new music and we just keep on listening to the music sort of our youth, of our 20s and teens and the early 30s. What about that? Is this you? Does it sound like you? Are you someone who keeps searching for new music no matter what your age is? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we're going to go now to Joe joining us in La Crosse. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I listen to all sorts of music largely because I teach at the university and I have a lab that I have a lot of college students in, and they're allowed to bring in whatever music they want or listen to whatever music they want, which exposes me to the current music, but they have to listen to what I listen to as well, which exposes them to what I used to listen to. And I think things like Pandora are great because you put in something that you like, and then it starts playing similar things that expose you to a whole bunch of music.
Great. Well, thanks for that, Joe. A bit of cross-pollination is good for everybody, Joe is saying. Do you think it works that way, Stephen?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the way, that streaming works now, I mean, it's easier than ever to discover new music. I mean, if you have, access to Pandora or you have a Spotify account, I mean, to subscribe to these services, it's a pretty nominal fee, like maybe $10 a month. Or you can go on YouTube, as many people do, and sample music there. And, all these streaming devices have some sort of discovery function where, like the guy who just called said that, if you like a certain artist, it'll suggest other artists who sound similar. If you go on Spotify, there's a similar thing on there as well. There's also, easy ways to find new releases on there. There's usually a social media aspect to a lot of these services, so you can see what your friends are listening to. If you do have a friend that still listens to new music, that's usually a great way to find out about new artists.
Let's get in one more quick call here. Alec is with us from Maquanago. Hi, Alec.
Hi. So I had read this article. I actually shared it with my girlfriend online, and I begged her. I said, please don't let us be these people, because we're 31 and 33 respectively right now.
You're right there.
Yep, we're right there. And I think that's probably true for a broad segment of people, that they stop listening to different types of music. But I think there's a huge section of people that also really pride themselves on getting to know new music. And I know the article is really mainly talking about pop music. No people who are going to be over 33 are going to listen to the new Ariana Grande album. But it doesn't mean they're not going to discover stuff that they didn't have an opportunity to listen to when they were younger, like really older jazz or like classical music. Because, following the genres as they evolve, the genres change so much. Punk isn't what it used to be when it started. Jazz has essentially stopped at like fusion and Latin jazz, so it's really tough to evolve. But also, I think that there's a lot of people who will hearken back to stuff that, they didn't know back in the day, and they'll discover stuff that was loved by other generations,
Great point. Thank you for that, Alec. And that's definitely me. I don't always listen to what's on the radio or new stuff, but, I discovered Wilco about 5 years ago. Probably everyone else in the world knew about Wilco. But what about finding bands and music that's new to you, but, maybe older?
Yeah, I think that's one of the great things about music. We talked earlier about how vast music is and how that can be intimidating. But the great thing about that is that, as many great TV shows as there are right now, it's a fairly limited thing. There's only so many shows that are as great as The Wire or The Sopranos or whatever. But there are so many, there's so many galaxies of music out there, just waiting to be explored. If you've never listened to jazz, just think of how many great eras of jazz there are, or how many great eras of folk music there are, or just pick any genre. And again, that music is more accessible now than it's ever been, probably ever, So yeah, just waiting for you to dive in.
We're talking right now to music critic Stephen Hayden about how we listen to music may change over time. Our conversation today in response to a recent article that suggests a lot of us stop listening and searching out new music around the age of 33. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is this your story? If you're in your 30s or beyond, do you prefer the music that you grew up with? Do you think of it as sort of comfort music, the music of your teens and your 20s? Or are you still seeking out the cool new stuff? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation now with Stephen Hayden, music critic and staff writer for Grantland. According to a recent analysis of music data from the website Spotify, a lot of us stop listening to new music and go back to the music of our teens and 20s starting around the age of 33. Not true totally for Rob Ferret, my co-host. This is a song I Sat by the Ocean by Queens of the Stone Age. Apparently this was Rob's jam for 2 years. He made an effort to get out there and look for new music. And we want to hear your story. Do you have a problem with music these days? Do you have a cutoff date for the music you listen to? Do you go back to those old comforting tracks from your teens, your 20s, your early 30s? Or do you go out there and look for new music? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we go now to, how about a Facebook comment here from John in Annapolis, who says, at age 57, I'm always on the lookout for new music. On my Android phone, Shazam is by far the most used app. I stumble across new music through radio stations, TV shows, movies, internet clips, YouTube videos. A lot of these discoveries, he says, lead to purchases, sometimes a single track and sometimes a full CD. So, Stephen, is that a good tool for people to explore the new world of music if they're getting stuck?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as the music industry has evolved, or some would say devolved, oftentimes the best way to get songs out there are through commercials or through television shows, you don't necessarily know like who the artist is or what the song title is. So like having something like Shazam is a great way to discover new artists, because you know that is often now how artists get exposed. I think it's a great idea.
We're gonna go back to the phones now. We've got Christine joining us from Appleton. Hi, Christine.
Hello. I'm 51, and I'm constantly looking out for new music. I actually get a lot of new music ideas from the New York Times. And so a good example is I have tickets to see Belle and Sebastian and Courtney Barnett. So I've been listening to Belle and Sebastian since I was in my 30s, and Courtney Barnett, the new artist that I really loved. And so I just think music is constantly evolving, and there's constantly good stuff.
Christine, does it take you a long time to search out that new music? That's an obstacle for some people, including me, is that you really have to sometimes go digging. Do you find it to be time-consuming?
Not really. I mean, I'm serious, and so there's a sort of a new music alternative station, and so there's constantly new music on there. And the Sunday New York Times has been great. I find a lot of good artists there.
Great. Well, thanks, actually. Christine. Appreciate your thoughts. And, Stephen, she goes to the New York Times, also Sirius, Spotify, Pandora. What do you recommend for finding new music?
Well, first off, I just want to second the Courtney Barnett recommendation. She made one of my favorite records of the year. I actually wrote a profile of her about her for Grantland, where I write, so I would recommend Grantland as a place to go. I have to plug my own site. I think really now, the New York Times, they have great music coverage. I think, social media is really another really great place to find out about new music, because, people, along with sharing everything else in their lives, they're constantly sharing like what they're listening to on Spotify or on any number of streaming services. And for as long as there's been music, like the best way to discover new artists is usually from recommendations that you get from your friends, and that is the best way, I think, to get it now. So if it's something you're interested in, you know, like the caller just said, it doesn't take that much work to find new artists that you might be into.
All right. Well, thanks for that call. Let's go next to Jack calling from Wisconsin Dells. Hey, Jack.
Hi there. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
So I'm more than double this cutoff age that you guys are talking about. Uh-huh. And I have been able to find new music because I got a subscription to a satellite radio. I'm too lazy to look in the New York Times and look stuff up. So I just listen. I make it a habit to go to a different station every other day or so just to see what's on. I had everything from all the classics that I like to Katy Perry to reggae to the down-home country boys at the Bean Blossom. So, and it's exciting for me because I think, like you guys said before, there's the same thing over and over again, but it's done differently each time, and it makes it exciting and it makes it fun to listen to.
Great place to leave it. Thank you, Jack. Jack is obviously an omnivore when it comes to his music. And just briefly, Stephen, as we wrap up, what encouragement would you give people to look for new music?
Yeah, I would just say that the attachment that you have to the records that you grew up with, you know, that's great and it's sacred, and I wouldn't discourage anyone from, like, revisiting music that they grew up loving. But I would just say that it's not as if you can't still have those connections with new songs. You know, if you think about how great those songs that you grew up with, you know, you can form those kind of relationships with songs now. So then when you're older than you are now, you can look back on this part of your life as being, you know, sort of a magical time, and that these artists kind of evoke that period. I mean, music,
Stephen,
really
thank
is.
You so much. We're going to leave it there. That was Stephen Hayden, a Wisconsin-based music critic and staff writer at Grantland. You can keep the conversation going at the Central Time Facebook page.